is about how these things are going to be affecting markets. And I think, at least from my perspective, it's, you know, a lot of the things that John had put in the agenda about this meeting go back to when the web turned from a read-only phenomenon to a read-write phenomenon, and people started to think of a more participatory web, and with blogging really just being sort of the first step, a huge and important one, but a pretty, you know, first one towards a more participatory web. And we now have things like Web 2.0 and lots of movements and movement towards that. And if you think about what people are saying, it's, you know, that the power is shifting to the user is at least both part of Web 2.0 itself and is a larger phenomenon. And in some sense, one of the essences that we're covering here in terms of user-centric identity, that it's about the user becoming more empowered. And so the question is really exploring, is that happening, how it's happening, why, the implications of it happening, business models and how they're going to be changed if it really does start to happen in significant ways. And so today's panel is a pretty interesting group of people to explore that. So we have Doc Searles, senior editor of Linux Journal, and Doc has been talking a lot about participation and actually even identity and user-centrism for quite a bit on his blog, which is pretty well read. And he's going to talk about a concept he calls the intention economy. I mean, I actually put the original Linux Journal post, I believe it was the original one that you did, there's a link to one of them anyway.
Yeah, a lot of them.
up on the conference, the hub site for this session. We're then going to hear from John Sviokla, he's the vice chairman of Diamond Cluster. He's going to talk about from the business side and how the capital that's currently chasing demand may get repurposed based on some of the things that happen, or if and when that'll happen. And then we're going to hear from Louise Gay, president and founder of My Virtual Model, which will provide a pretty interesting demonstration of services that are actually start to change and bust up some of the original business models and how companies view their customer database and how they will be interacting with customers. So, and then one final note, Larry Weber, who is on the agenda, could not make it. We posted a podcast he did and a Skype cast up to the community hub site as well. So if you want to get a sense of Larry's perspective, you can go look at that. So let's start it off with Doc.
And actually, we voted him off.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's off the island.
There'll only be one guy left up here, I think. That's a new variation on conferencing. You just get the panels, and you just gradually vote everybody off, and then you have no more panelists left. I'd like to go back to 1999, or actually 1998, when Chris Locke, David Weinberger, and Rick Levine and I were co-lamenting the complete misunderstanding of what we saw the net was back then. It was the height of the dot-com madness, and enormous amounts of money were funding advertising and banners and pet shops and all kinds of stuff on the net. And an interesting thing to us was that it seemed to us that what the net did was it empowered the demand side far more than it empowered the supply side, as dramatic as the empowerment was. So we wrote the Clue Train Manifesto, and how many people here have read or know anything about the Clue Train Manifesto? Most of you, yeah. We called it a manifesto because it worked for Marx, and we went to 95 Theses because that worked for Luther, and we nailed those up on the net. But there are a couple things that stand out from that I think they're relevant to this, because we made some observations that I think have not yet come true, and I think that's what we're in the room to try and help make come true. One was that networked markets get smarter faster than most companies. And that got picked up by other people. Well, network churches get smarter, you know, network congregations get smarter faster than most churches, and networked schools get smarter faster than most education systems and so forth. But there's another thing that Chris Locke actually wrote. It was galvanizing for us with Clue Train, which was that he made a statement. He put it in a little GIF, and he sent it out to the rest of us that said, "We are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings, and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it." And I didn't realize until later, but that was actually a first-person statement on the part of markets against marketing. And And actually, it was Jakob Nielsen who told us later that we had defected from marketing and went over and sided with markets. I hadn't realized that's what we were doing, but that's what he said. And but the interesting thing is, I think our reach. I don't think that's happened yet. I don't think we've reached the point where the customers are more empowered, or where they're not being treated with full respect. So, a brief story. When not long after the book came out, there was a website, then it was a book, and the book sold well, and suddenly three of us at least that were extroverts had speaking careers. And I was on one of these junkets, and I was sitting in the back of a plane next to this guy named Shayo Ajiboye, who is a Nigerian pastor who had recently translated the Bible to Yoruba, which is his native language. He spoke English at least as well as I did and understood a great many things very deeply. And he asked me about Clue Train, and I told him what it was about. And he said, markets of conversations is very interesting and, like, pretty good for, you know, like a rich guy from the first world, but, you know, it goes deeper than that. And I said, well, explain that. And he said, well, what do you see going on in what he called a natural market, a market in a less developed world where you don't have a big supply side that's in charge and setting all the prices for you? And I said, well, you know, there's a lot of people making a lot of noise, and you go, and he said, you took this pillow, and he said, well, let's say you know a lot about textiles, and this is a garment, and what's your first question? And I said, well, what's it cost? He said, well, you would ask that because you're from the part of the world where, you know, you expect that to be the first question. He said, well, what happens if in the course of a conversation, the vendor learns a great deal about what you know, which may be dyes and manufacturing, and you learn a great deal about what he knows, which may be native crafts and weaving and stuff like that. What happens? What happens to the price? He says, well, what happens is you may end up wanting to pay more, and he may end up wanting to charge less. In other words, you don't just discover the price inside the conversation, but you develop what? He was being Socratic with me. I said, a relationship. He said, most of what's going on in a natural marketplace is, in fact, relationships. There's a level above transaction and conversation that matters more than either of those in its relationship. And in my world, if you were to look at that in terms of a pyramid of emphasis, the largest part of that is relationship, little less conversation, and transaction is actually the least part of it. And in your part of the world, you've devoted entire B schools to transaction and paid very little attention to the other parts. So, with that in mind, I like that model, because a little bit later, I was talking to Eric Raymond, who's one of the fathers of the open source movement, and he also described markets as having these three components: relationship, conversation, and transaction. It would be easy if we just looked at markets in terms of those three things. These are the three things that tend to happen. And we've developed one of those really well, another one not quite as well, and the last one kind of least well of all. And I think what we want to do with identity is develop the relation part of this. So just to jump ahead, this last spring, I was at ETECH, the O'Reilly ETECH conference in San Diego, and it was about attention. It was about the attention economy, it was called. And I heard so many talks that were all about, guess what? Seats and eyeballs and end users and consumers and grabbing people's attention and doing marketing 101, you know, or, you know, marketing 1.0. It wasn't web 2.0. It was like marketing 1.0 done all over again on the net. And it seemed to be what was missing here is what I call the intention economy. The intention economy is what happens when the customer has his mind made up or her mind made up. Marketing is now out of the room. You know, I'm coming to Cambridge, I want to rent a car. Who's going to come through for me? How do I express that to the marketplace? There's an awful lot of money that's wasted right now trying to get people to buy stuff, when in fact the money that's going to be spent is on the user's side, it's on the customer's side, and we have not yet equipped the customer and the marketplace with the instruments that they require in order to get the goods to come to them, rather than just go like a bee from flower to flower to flower to flower, from going from silo to silo to silo, essentially, looking for the best deal. There's nothing wrong with that. But we have this notion, we've had it for a long time, that a free market is your choice of silo. And a free market is actually something much more than that. You know, this is the argument, for example, right now that the carriers are making on the net neutrality debate. Well, we don't want government interfering with business. Business is what? our monopoly or their monopoly, right? We just that's your choice, and that's a perfectly and people go with that because they think that's a natural thing. It's not. It's this aberrant, weird thing we've had through the entire Industrial Revolution and haven't outgrown yet. And I think our job here is to outgrow that by equipping the customer and equipping the marketplace with something it does not yet have. In fact, I've gone so far as to think that we talk about the commons, but we haven't developed it yet. There is no commons. We haven't got that yet. There's not that space. We don't fully understand that space. So the idea that I have is that what all of us need, what identity is really about, is what I call a box of intentions and relationships. This is what we need to be carrying around. Here's my box. I have these relationships. I'm not necessarily willing to reveal who I am yet, or I have a lot of control over what I say about myself. But essentially, a lot of this the details of identity we've been talking about today, they need to be solved. But in the marketplace, we need to just solve these two things. What do we do with our intentions, and what do we do with our relationships, and how do we make those work? So I think if we do that, then we'll have an intention-based economy and save ourselves a lot of grief.
Okay, John?
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure, Doc, to be here with you. Your thinking clearly was early and spectacular. My interest is similar in many ways. I've been fascinated for the past about 10 years or so, or actually longer, about the interaction of the kind of information environment with the physical environment. And this notion of the intention economy, the notion I'd like to talk briefly about is that, which I think is, rhymes with what you're saying, is I'd really like to have a market where you have liquidity and preference. That is, my preferences are tradable on my terms and conditions, perhaps, or perhaps I sell those decision rights to other people. But if you can have tradable preference, then you can have both supply and demand. I think we'll simultaneously see things get more transactional and relational at the same time. I think that both of those deepen simultaneously. But that's I think, kind of where I'm going to go. To me, I want to bookmark a couple of things. First of all, I think we have two huge identity management systems that probably will not change a lot over the next 5 to 10 years. One is the way governments identify us, and the other one is credit cards. Credit cards on a global basis are the best identity management system created. There are about 200 billion credit cards in China right now. They're going, according to Morgan Stanley, by 2009, there'll be 600 million. That'll be the biggest increase in credit cards in the history of mankind. We are also in this country going to see the biggest transfer of wealth in the history of mankind as the baby boomers, the people in this room, begin to spend their wealth on their health. That will be, and believe me, they'll spend it, right? How much is a year worth? Or lack of wrinkle. The other thing I'd like to keep in mind is that the demographic in this room is not the core demographic of what I'm about to talk about, which is marketing. Just to give you an idea, in our $11 trillion economy in the United States, we have something like $1 to $2 trillion chasing demand. When I say chasing demand, I mean there's about $600 billion in advertising and promotion. That is equivalent to the gross domestic product of Australia. Okay. Today, there's been $2 billion trying to get your attention spent. Second Life is about 6 seconds. All the money that's going to be spent on Second Life today is about 5 to 6 seconds worth of promotional activity in the country. So I think we have to get, Second Life can give us some interesting insights, but we've got to remember the magnitude of what we're talking about here. So when we talk about business models, you look at somebody like Google, they're just one of the few companies that actually can match supply and demand in a very crude manner, where they actually auction off demand. I mean, if you think about Google's business model, they're auctioning demand to the highest bidder. And thanks to a 27-year-old guy who they actually do it with closed bid pricing where you pay the second highest bid, which increased their revenue by 7 times, if you guys followed that. So they use decision analytic. You can prove that in a repeat closed bid auction, the best way to extract everybody's reservation price is to make the highest bidder pay the second highest bidder's price plus a penny, which is what Google did. And the day they did that, their revenue went up 7x. So they're tremendously sophisticated in terms of the way they auction off that demand, but they are in the business of auctioning off demand. And we work for very large companies. Just to give you an idea, the second largest publication in this country. Anybody tell me the second largest publication in this country, magazine?
Parade.
Parade? I wasn't thinking Parade as a magazine, but okay, I'll give you Parade. The third largest then would be Food and Family by Kraft. Anybody in here get Food and Family? No. Right? I do. I actually like some of the recipes, although some of them are pretty gross. But they send it to 14 million people. 14 million people, six times a year. So there are and they can also take that down to Zip Plus 4 targeting, and it turns out that you can actually increase significantly. If you use that information, you can increase significantly the consumption of certain consumer products. But I mean, there are these huge activities, and the address and the amount of money that is spent trying to get at that demand and the scale of these organizations is something to keep in mind. Just for another kind of factoid, one of the largest television networks in the country is Walmart TV. That is the TV inside of Walmart. There's 135 million people a week who go to Walmart. McDonald's serves 50 million people a day. There are 5,000, in an experiment, there's 5,000 Wi-Fi enabled McDonald's. Okay? McDonald's has to grow a full Starbucks a year to stay even. So the magnitude of some of these organizations, I think, I just want to bring that to the background, because when we figure out how to use identity to make marketing more efficient, believe me, there's going to be a lot of money chasing it, just as there is with the Google market valuation. I mean, why can Google build data centers? Because the people who are buying their stock understand that if they can hotwire that $1 trillion to a better end, they'll get the margins. Okay, one last thing. This is in the context on a global basis of a fundamental dematuring of the information cluster. I would put to you that there's not one thing as a consumer product or an industrial product in this world that has changed more in the past 10 years, both in its supply and demand, than information. Not healthcare, not clothing, not food, not anything. Information is the most changed thing that we buy and use on a global basis, and it's changing at a faster rate. The entire industry is dematuring. It's going from a set of mature industries to a set of immature industries. And there's a very specific definition of that, which is you have an increasing number of equivalent competitors. So you have Verizon and Comcast are doing an overbuild in this geography and beating each other up on core issues. I'm a little bit different place than Doc is. I think that it's actually going to get pretty interesting, even if they get their net neutrality, whatever, non-net neutrality. The second thing is that people are buying different stuff. And the third thing is that the core technologies of manufacturing are changing. Because, like IP, voice over IP. So that industry is dematuring at a fundamental level, which means that every single company that has to get their message to market is dealing with a distribution of information that is completely different and will change even more over the next 10 years than it has in the past 10 years. So this $1 trillion I'm talking about is up for grabs for anybody who can figure out how to make it addressable and tie it to identity at whatever level the end customer thinks is of value.
Okay, Louise?
Okay, so just before we will start the presentation, because we brought some visual, and I am a little bit surprised the MIT people had some visual, but we talk a lot about identity, and there are no images, no sound. It's very, very like speeches. So here we are bringing some visual. Why? Because we want to share with you our experience. We created my virtual model in 1998. And now 10 million people have their virtual model. We did it because to shop online was difficult. You cannot see yourself. You cannot try on. And it started like this with Lens End. But also, I will share it with you. It's not absolutely not a commercial speech, but we want to share all what we have discovered because people are using it, they want to use it more, and they want to bring their models in games and in other world. But we are really between the user and the merchant. So just before we enter in the My Virtual Model, because it's about identity, I thought it could be interesting just to share a little bit of my identity with you. And so about the origin and the genesis. So I have done a collage.
First one on the right, I think.
Is it?
Now you know why we kept it to speeches.
Well, no, no, we will have it. Oh. It's here.
It's on one.
The collage, you will see, I have done it in my PhD. It was a pocket museum, and it was a tool for children to create their own portrait of identity and doing it with a multimedia database and at the same time creating a virtual friend. And I hope this will work, because anyway, if it does not work, then I will invite you to come and see it. But the whole idea with my virtual model and the collage was really to show how poetry, for me, is a very important virtual world as childhood. And I even brought some movie excerpts to show it. And for the My Virtual Model itself, how many people created their virtual model here? Few people, but many, many women use my virtual model to shop online, to mix and match. Oh, it's there?
Almost.
Hey, we need faith to see identity. Okay, so let's show very quickly the collage. You will recognize many visionary artists, poets. I really like the Glenn Gould excerpt when he says that as an interpret, he'll recreate. And I also like the Aida excerpt, because really when I started to study their culture, they really develop a visual language, a visual grammar. And I think that it's starting to happen on the web. People express themselves a lot with all these images. And there is another part of the collage where it's more about women and technology. And at eBay, I was always struck, because Meg Whitman is saying that the success is based on the user. They do everything. They do the promotion, the auction, absolutely everything. And so let's show the short excerpts of the movie, maybe, at least the first, because we don't have a lot of time. This is this movie from Jean Cocteau is all about poetry to pass from one world to another, and he was able to very early with special effects to invite us in virtual reality. Normally there is a sound where the magic is much better. Then let's go in the virtual model itself. So this short excerpt, I thought it was very beautiful, because it's really childhood as virtual world. And working with children, I realized that they go from one world to another. They publish what they do. They never have any inhibition about one world and another. So they have been always a constant inspiration for me. So now the virtual model will come back to the roadmap. So you will see that it's really a questionnaire that you fill. And the idea is that this avatar, when it looks like you, it's better because it can recommend size, predict fit, but it's not completely you. And that's very interesting, because we know that people use avatar to fantasize, but here it's really to follow their own model. We'll also show you the example of the virtual home, because in the collage, inspired especially by the Aida, I wanted to show that technology bring back art and beauty in our life. A little bit like in this traditional society, where you see boxes, simple objects, and everything is very beautiful. So I see that more people use technology. They introduce this possibility to design, to create their world. Here you have seen that people create their closet, which I think is much more important than to understand a store. They store what they purchase, and they store what they have selected. So with their permission, they really like to be promoted because it will be about something that they really have selected previously. So you can see also that there is a combination of Zoom where you see all the details and you combine with the interaction. And of course, the eternal question is who owns the data? Because when people start to really create their 3D body, they create also their home. We will go very quickly on this one. You can create now on the Sears site your entire home, your bedroom, your kitchen, and you can always try on products. And the people have asked for more. They said, not only I want to try on products, I want to do it with a planner, to really see the products in my kitchen, in the rooms of my home. And tomorrow we will show an example of the planner on the Best Buy site using Higgins to show how it's very interesting to combine a control of your identity. And at the same time, when we were on the Lens and site, people did not understand that you fill a questionnaire to create your own chinos, and you have to fill almost the same questionnaire to create your model. And again, if you are using a personal shopper feature, you will not be able to try it on your model. It's not integrated. So there is a real demand for people that using your virtual model, it should be totally user-centric. The third section I want to show and share with you. We are on the website of our clients, the second most used features after search engine. So we thought, hey, people need to look for what they need, what they want, and they want to personalize, to simulate. Why not combine both? So imagine that you are watching TV with a friend and she sees someone on the TV wearing a blouse, or it's a mix of t-shirt and a blouse, and she likes it. It's simple, it's casual, and she would like to get it. So why not invite her to go and use a visual search engine? This is an example. You will see Frugal, but it's just a demo. So you choose the clothing, and then because we are in the world of garment and fashion, you decide to use maybe your virtual model if you already have it, or a generic model. You choose the top, and it's a shirt. You try it on. The sleeves were short, so let's choose short sleeve. And then the color was a V-neck. Yes, it looks like what she saw. So, hey, go for a search. And then you have the list of all the possible products. And if one of these products is tryable, why not? And then the last example, you just bought a rustic house in the country and just want to very beautiful refrigerator. The rest should be very, very rustic. Let's go in the appliances. You start, you look for refrigerator. You want to show me my search. And I want a side-by-side. And I would like it. I want to choose a color. It should be trendy, stainless. It looks like what I'm looking for. And then I really want to go for a search. And among the result, there is one refrigerator with a screen. So I will zoom, resume, and I can even see it in my kitchen, as we have shown you. So we think that as an individual, if you can configure your desire, show your desire, not just look for, but start by, in fact, your secret identity, it's interesting. So we have not shown it before. That's really the first time that we share it with a public. And imagine you do this, then you will store in your closet or in virtual room what you have done, and we call it for now a database of simulation. And I have not shown you the roadmap, but we work, of course, in the business to consumer, but our technology, our tools are also used by brands to simulate their collection before they go to production. And they will go even from 2D to 3D, so they will sell before they produce, and we like it because we feel it's very eco-friendly. And of course, they will test with user, the market, with the virtual products. So corporation will use the same tools that consumer use. And consumer can store, as I said, their configuration in this database of simulation. And this is a place where the B2C can meet the B2B. Mm-hmm. So for now, we have clients, we work with consumer, but we are really seeing in the market a meeting of all these worlds. So for us, this conference is very important because our mission is to create the standard for virtual identities since 1998. And as we are not lawyers, nobody understood us when we were talking about virtual identity. But now our clients realize the power of the simulation, this visual, this audio-visual, this multimedia language, and they start to really pay interest to virtual identity and digital identity. So I think it's important that Microsoft, Egan's, IBM, eBay, Google, together really make it happen because there is a real need.
Go ahead. Can I just say one thing? First, that's spectacular. The what I think is yes. I just want to highlight something you went over, I think, kind of quickly, which I think is central. You said that people will pre-buy based on this, and that is liquidity and preference, right? You're saying, okay, my intention economy. One of the most fascinating things about that, and you also kind of elided over the fact that that allows you to trade both at the individual consumer level and business to business. And the fundamental thing that's wrong with the economy, the next level of efficiency, I think, is that risk and intention is traded at the wrong level of granularity.
I agree.
So what you say, and what this, I mean, and Chris Anderson's long tail is just kind of one implication of it, is it's not just the efficiency of the channel. If I can express intention, we can radically change risk structures because I don't have to ship it to the store, and the store's going to return it to me, and
absolutely,
it didn't sell in the window and all that other stuff. And the thing is that every time in the history of the economy, the shared stock company, mortgage-backed securities, life insurance, any time we have a risk absorption mechanism, wealth creation takes off. It doesn't go up a little bit. It goes wild. And this is a huge wealth creation mechanism.
Here, that's exactly what you're talking about, because we see that we started in the B2C, where, of course, people want to see their model. The young people want to beam their virtual model in the window display of the store. For them, it's a natural thing. So then it's so much alive to think in those terms. Stores are changing.
Right. This is doing for fashion what mortgage-backed securities did for mortgages, which is you can, you know, you go get your mortgage and it goes into a big
bundle. But believe
me,
we work with
speaking to the mic.
So we work in the B2B and with home builders.
Sure.
And they take care of insurance. It starts, we start at the CAD, you know, because we shorten all the process. So you're totally right. It touches all the aspects of the commerce.
So you have to convince the site owner to let go of their customer database in order to enable this, though, right? Which I imagine is not necessary, or at least they would perceive it as a threat to their ownership of data, maybe.
I mean, it depends on how they do it. They don't necessarily have to do it that way. I can
I understand
the
they don't.
Data.
I'm asking her if they see it that way, though.
Louise, is it, yes? Do your site owners see it as giving up the data? Am I?
Yeah.
At the beginning, I must say that the first time I presented my virtual model to my first customer, and I was very impressed by him, a very successful businessman, he was so angry, you know? He almost kicked me out of the room, and I was surprised because I was glad to have achieved, because the model is mobile. You can go from one website to another, but I was stealing his treasure because I heard so many times, we own the customer. Right. And they say it with, not love, but with ownership. And so many times I said, hey, you know, things are evolving and people are now more and more so interactive and they can co-design. There will be a new model. You have seen the visual search engine. That's interesting from a business model. And we are asked already, we reuse the digital assets, we bring it in games, because it's a fun way to shop. You play a game and the products are in low res, but they know that if they want to have it in high res and really manipulate it, they can. Many, many women told me in movie, it's an alive catalog. I watch a movie, I like what the actress wears, I expect that on the DVD, on the extra, I will go online, try on my model as seen in the collection, prepare and tailor for you know, the style shown in the movie. These are things we are doing now. Hmm. That's the future of retail today. I want to pay tribute to the two people at least. Of course, tomorrow my partner will really make a presentation about the B2B world and the financial aspect, and I think it will be very interesting. But the configurator of configurators, we really develop it with people working here, with Frank Piller, because really, Frank, you really show us we were doing things that we did not know how to name. You have helped us to formalize and with the, because the model is a kind of configurator for customization. And with Eric Van Ippel for the democratization of innovation. And it's very helpful for us because the retailers and the merchant we're working with, they want to bring these things, but they fight with their own vision of the world. Mm-hmm. But believe me, we have to come with agreement because the timing is now.
So I have a question. So would it be possible for a customer to broadcast to the marketplace an intention to buy a design?
That's the database of simulation.
Next question. Would it be possible to do it over one of these, over a cell phone?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because that's the killer
Chris,
thing.
Chris, are you here? Did you bring your iPod? We'll show you some example. Yes. Absolutely.
So this sounds like something you were talking about, Doc. I mean, what I'd like to hear you two do is react to what you've seen. Obviously, you think it's moving towards changing the way chasing demand is allocated. So who, I mean, if things are moving in this direction, who wins, who loses? That was one of the questions that came up. What are the characteristics of business models that succeed in that, you know, and how does it move?
Let me say just one short thing.
Sure.
We're very accustomed to having a sort of zero-sum thing that says, okay, well, the power shifts from, you know, like there's one mountain and the vendors had it and now the customers have it. No, it's we're originating new ones. I don't think anybody has to lose, actually. I think if you're clueful, you can win all kinds of new ways.
Okay, so how can you win?
I think we need to build out the mechanisms. I don't think we have the mechanisms yet. I mean, that's basically it. This looks like one very good one to me.
Just to unpack some of the examples from history, when mortgage-backed securities came, that's basically bundling of end customer mortgages into a bigger security that then goes out in hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars through a syndicate of investment banks, which is called a conduit. And That just multiplied the amount of capital available to the market, which then allowed more people to buy clothes. So this thing, I don't know what the number is. I was thinking back to McCabe's presentation about the difference between 52% and 91% efficiency of the market. You know, I bet it's of that order of magnitude or larger, because you've got a chain of markets that each have that inefficiency,
right.
And then you've got the whipsaw effect of, right. You know, gee, I'm a fashion retailer, and I saw, you know, and whatever, Charlize Theron, you know, wore this, and so now I send it to China, and then it comes back, and again, all that stuff gets collapsed. So in time, and I can just manage the information value chain as opposed to the physical value chain. And the problem with the physical value chain is that risk trades at the wrong level of, that has more to do with how it's distributed.
Right.
And the amount, you know, just moving stuff around is 11% of the economy.
Right. But here you will see the object at the end, which right. is also another advantage. Because when you buy something, the object has been manipulated and is a little bit utilized. Here, you can imagine that only when you buy it, you see it.
I mean, I think the I don't think there have to be losers. There are plenty of people who essentially have businesses that are parasitic on the inefficiencies, but you know, you don't have to feel bad for them. They're like because they'll find something else to do. There's always a room for parasite, right? I mean, every system has a parasite. The
you wouldn't live without some of them, actually.
But what are some examples, just so we
well,
know?
Well, here's to bet on. Yeah, back in 1975. Before Walmart forced the industry over time to do what they call efficient consumer response, 50% of anything you bought in a grocery store would have gone through what was called a diverter, and it was called high-low pricing. So Tide would say, gee, it's coming to the end of the quarter. Procter & Gamble would say, we got to push some more Tide. So they would go out into the marketplace, and they'd do a promotion. They'd say, buy 5 boxes now and get 20% off. 50% of that would not go to the supermarket. 50% would go to an intermediary called a diverter, who was essentially a trader who would take possession of the inventory and then resell it after the thing went down. So that 50%, I don't know what the number is now, but it's trivial. Nobody goes through diverters anymore. So that's just a huge inefficiency that now ends up either in, you know, the shareholders of Walmart or in your pocket or a lower, you know, realized price or something else. So that's a big example. And, you know, same thing with insurance brokers. You know, the commissions are coming down. What Schwab did and, you know, when fixed commissions went away in the stock trading business, huge amounts of value end up down to the end consumer.
Real estate agents.
Real estate agents have been more resistant. And I think
and organized, too. They really are organized.
Well, yeah. The parasites are
there. It's a local cabal in every case.
But I think it goes back to the thing that you said, which is that the syntax and semantics would be the lingo I'd throw at it, but the infrastructures on real estate are not built out the way this is, and the fungibility of those assets is very low, and the importance of local information is very high, and the incentives to keep local information local are also very high.
Mm.
So, you know, that's going to be a hard market to make liquid. This market, I think, will be much, much more liquid. And I mean, the scary thing is every time you get somebody's attention, it's a shopping event, right? Because you'll have a patina. Like right here. Here I am, Austin Hall. I'd really like that detail, you know. And we will get there, which is, you know, any version of reality. Pause, purchase, if your credit's good.
We need to get a mic down here.
You'll need a microphone.
Let's just go ahead and open it up to questions. We've got a couple here on the board.
All right, I've got my mic. Britt Blazer, Open Resource Group. You know, we don't want to hear news, especially when we're on the web. We don't want people spamming us. We don't want announcements because we're at home. But it seems to me if I walk through town, it's 6:30 in the evening, I'm in the West Village, I suddenly want somebody on my buddy list who has a bar, okay, or I want a sandwich at noon. And so we have these temporal openings, sort of like these wormholes
right.
into our intimacy. And, you know, we run into a good bartender. That's, you know, we have this conversation. That's a terrific happenstance. And I think that's a piece of the present
space.
You said
intention is very volatile. And,
welcoming. We're on the web.
Right.
It's not welcoming.
That's an interesting thing. I mean,
but you can program virtual bar. You can, you know, the creativity.
Yeah.
Yes.
But so let's get the mics out and let's.
Yeah, there's a couple of mics back there. Take, come on, friend.
So I,
We'll go out there.
Google is a really good example where intent is important on the web. When I go search on Google, half the time I'm trying to buy something, and I get ads that are given to me with based on the words I'm searching for. So there are cases where it is important to what I'm doing, and I want my intent to be part of that, even on the web, whether I'm local or not.
Okay, so do we have other questions out in the audience? We've got a couple up on the wiki.
Could I just add one thing to that? I think thinking about the web is looking backward. I think that you really have to think about, we know what the next version of the web is. It's some combination of the phones and the web. And contextual awareness at the phone level, especially, you see this consortium with the new Linux operating system, I think we're going to have much better contextual awareness on the next generation of phones. And, you know, much better integration of Wi-Fi, WiMAX. And I think Microsoft's going to continue to crater, and, you know, in that market. And I don't think Microsoft will win the handset market. Motorola is the biggest. I think the Q is the best thing that's out there, and it's still more complicated than the Palm OS. But anyway, in the Symbian. But so I just think that the contextualization doesn't have to be as sterile as the web. It'll have communication. It'll have location awareness. And when you start taking these kinds of things and layer that in to what Doc was saying, you know, when you have those structures for expression and transaction, it could be very intimate.
There's this interesting division that's going on right now between what I've been calling the static web and the live web. It was interesting to me that, for example, when Google chose to do blog search to compete with Technorati and Ice Rocket and Feedster, they didn't work RSS search into their regular search engine. They created a second search engine called Google Blog Search. How many people have used that? How many people even know it exists? It's pretty interesting. I mean, you can go to blogsearch.google.com, look up identity mashup, and you'll get what people have been saying here today. And it'll say, so many minutes old, so many hours old. You know, it's current, it's live. And Google and Technorati, their goal is to get down under a minute between the time somebody posts something and an RSS feed goes out, and it's indexed in that search engine and it's searchable. And then those things are in turn syndicated. So, for example, some of us, I do this all the time, I have a subscription now to Identity Mashup as a feed, as a search feed into my aggregator. And that's fed in a more or less constant basis. This is the live web. And there are two different metaphorical systems that we've had for understanding the web. One is it's real estate. We have sites with addresses and locations. We have architects and designers and builders, and it's a big project to make a website, right? And the information highway goes past it and it needs traffic, right? It's big and it's thundering and it's real estate and it's development. And then there's this other side, which is writing. You know, we post something and we syndicate it and we write it and we author it, and that's much more lightweight. But if we look at the live side as not just that essentially the syndicated web, but also everything that's happening with messaging, texting. And in Europe, I was just in Copenhagen last week, and somebody said, "Well, I'll just text you on this." I mean, text is a verb there, and it's much more well used. I read a couple days ago that email is for teenagers becoming a way to communicate with the old folks, right? Because they're using text, they're not using email. The way that they're gathering into groups and doing interesting things, this is happening on the most personal device, which is not a laptop, it's a cell phone. Right. So to me, I think the box of relationships and intentions that I imagine is moving through the world with is one of these and not necessarily a laptop, or maybe it is the $100 PC or the, you know, something like that as well. Who knows?
I bet it's a combo.
It's probably some, you know.
Well, let's get to a couple of the questions that are up on the wiki, and two of them are for you, Luis, and I'll just combine them. So there's one, can you make your virtual model accessible to other people? And then with a virtual model, how do you deal with the tactile portion of apparel purchases? You know, how the clothes feel when you buy them.
Who has asked the question?
That was anonymous. So.
Okay.
Who here is anonymous?
No, but I would like.
Dick's hand went up first.
Because the virtual model, yes, people in fact come and pick their virtual model on our site, and they use it to lose weight. There is a real incredible usage for weight loss. And we will make it more easier for people to use, because we realize that, hey, if it's easier to see yourself with some pounds less than a top model that you are not. So very motivational, and we have many examples of blog. Right now, I think that the television program The Biggest Loser uses they use my virtual model. They invite people to go on the site, and there is always now a mix. But I was wondering what this person mean exactly, because it's really, maybe it's, is it open source? Not yet, but it's coming.
Okay. Does it, do whoever posted the question want to clarify for Luis?
Yes. Yes.
So wait till the mic gets to you there.
You mean, for example, if I send a wish list?
I was interested in if the, when you create your roadmap or you build your home or whatever, if you can invite other people to come in and visit it, to see what your plans are, to talk with you about it, if there's any sort of a collaborative aspect to
Absolutely.
This.
For now, people, for example, create their wish list and they send it with their model, things like this. But we have been asked to be not only one model on the screen, but several. For example, for the family, or there is this demand, and we bought an island in Second Life, and I will speak with you. We really want to do things, and it's demand by the user.
And so what about the second question about the tactile feel of apparel purchases? You know,
What is it exactly?
The tactile feel, touching the cloth.
Oh, that's... It's true that it's common that people say, you know, when I buy, I need to touch.
Yeah.
But with the Zoom, we realize that it's a kind of substitution. It's not completely, but because the photograph is of quality. So when we combine many media, then this comment is less done. But I know that there are technology, and it would be interesting to add.
I think the other thing that about this is, it's not, I doubt it'll be a complete substitute. If you think about it, there'll be a leading market that will use this, and that leading
That's
market
right.
will become more and more mainstream. The interesting thing for me is it radically reduces the risk of traditional marketing then.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a hit in your world, that's probably more likely to be a hit in the broader world. It's kind of like if you go to British Petroleum, they're not British Petroleum anymore, sorry, BP, the green company. The in comparison to Exxon, maybe. The that they have not drilled a dry hole in 15 years because they have such good seismic data and models of the geology. So the question is, how many fewer dry holes in every part of industrial and consumer activity can we do? What's the 3D? You're starting to build the 3D. You are the Schlumberger of fashion, right? you're starting to build the 3D seismic for, you know. Now, you're probably still at this. You're not yet going downhole with the cameras and the sensors. You know, you're detonating dynamite, and you're checking out the sound waves off the salt domes. I mean, we're at that level. But it's still a lot better than the guys with the divining rods walking around, which is how most of fashion is done.
But we see that that was a little bit one of the message I wanted to communicate with you, that I was educated in a world where there was the head and the body. And I see that when we, with like this metaphor, we live by and the body in the mind, where images, it's I think Johnson and Lakoff, the images are very natural for us, very rich, and in fact, should not be considered as a less conceptually strong language. And I think that when you can really show what you want, it's powerful. And we see it happening.
If you go to Johnson and Lakoff, you're saying that poetry will get you to the metaphors you need. So you don't really need to feel it because
you'll know it's life.
You
create images with words.
Yeah. It's like chenille, only it's more like velvet or some other thing like that.
Mm-hmm. For some markets, and for other markets, it'll be because, you know, Beyoncé wore it. That'll be enough. No poetry involved.
No, the poetry of figures.
So do we have other questions from the audience?
I have a very short comment, which is looking at this, which is so cool. It's just become so self-evident how incredibly ancient and creaking the current marketing approaches are that are based on something like, can you believe it, a zip code? When you compare the value of demographic data to the accumulated click stream of an organization like this, and the amount that is known about the person and what it takes to sell to that person. And none of it is based on any identity information in the traditional sense. This is really a new kind of relationship with the individual in which this old brick and mortar stuff just goes to sleep.
I'd actually say I think it'll be a combination. Because if you look at, there's an object lesson out there. I don't know if you followed Harris Entertainment, which is run by a guy named Gary Lubman, who used to teach at Harvard Business School. And he is a very sophisticated guy about applying direct marketing and designing the whole experience. And he took what was a terrible property in the gaming business. And I don't know, I mean, I have problems with the gaming business in general, but leave that aside for a minute. He is now neck and neck with MGM. He has taken that organization and put it right to the top of the industry with some of the lousiest properties out there just by combining traditional marketing, that is promotional activity, but in the context of analysis. And I think my guess is you're right that most of them are creaking, but I think it's going to be a combination of physical and informational, old style, new style. And the question is, it's out of balance today. For sure, but it's like the problem with Chris Alexander stuff. It's not, the small's not going to be big. The small's going to be bigger, and the big is going to be ginormous based on what are the things you pick out of the small.
And imagine try on banner, where when you click, it's your model there and the product that are linked to really what you like. Exactly. But he says, if you lie to me, I will lie to you.
So we're running out of time. I think Johannes had a question.
Well, it's maybe just putting in context what we had this morning and when I heard Second Life, and of course Louise and the different comments of what's being done on Google. Is the identity system going to catch up with what the other innovation coming up? What is the panel's objective? Because it seems to me like we've heard a lot of major challenge this morning on making this work and getting it together. And then I'm hearing about Second Life doing this many revolution on the way. So is it that the regulatory framework and the kinks and the technology is going to come after the revolution? Just interested in the panel's perspective on that.
Well, that's a deeply that's probably the reason John had this conference to answer that question. But I think that the normative uses of this stuff have always, the regulatory and legal structures to govern it have trailed its use, normative use, by years, if not decades. And I doubt that will change. In fact, it'll only spread out, which is part of why today's other panels were somewhat contentious around certain issues, because it raises tough problems. I certainly think that the other thing that I found the most interesting about today, or found very interesting about it, is that, and why I'm here, quite frankly, is that, when you look at this from the traditional technological terms, you're seeing only a very small piece of the picture. It's these business models that are going to fundamentally create many of the systems that we're looking for, and if we don't create it, somebody else will, a la Louise. So with that, I'm getting the signal we're done. So join me in thanking the panelists.